Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad you can join me for a little bit of cardboard conversation, or rather conversation about cardboard. We hope the conversation is better than cardboard. If it's the same as cardboard, at least I'm hoping it's white stock as opposed to gray stock. Everything looks better on white stock, I believe. But white stock, gray stock, tomato, tomato, we'll call the whole thing off. Nope. We've got lots to talk about today. As you may recall, a few weeks ago, we got talking about shoebox memories. You know, that one picture that was shared in our Wax and Gumstein's Twitter timeline. And it had the kid who's like 8 years old laying on his bed, staring at some baseball cards. He's got a shoebox full of baseball cards right next to him. And I had one of those shoebox esque moments recently, and it's all tied into our special guest this week. As throughout the years, I've collected a lot of cards from the 1970s. And over the last few years, as I've refined my collection, basically kept all the cards from 1987 and prior, the only cards I have from 88 and forward are cards from sets that I have hand-collated. And there's a couple of sets I'm still working on, and there's a few that I've completed. But most of my collection is from 1987 and prior. And as my collection has been refined over the years, most of the cards from 1981 through 87 are sitting in the big old monster box. Yes, the big 5,000-count box that started this podcast over 3 years ago. So that's where the bulk of my 1980s cards are. The common cards, if you will. You know, the star cards and rookie cards, they ended up in the plastic pages and various top loaders. Well, the cards from the 1970s, I've had to split up a little bit. And it's because a lot of the cards from, say, 1976 through 1980... most of them are common cards. Most of them I have bought through packs and lots. And I would take out the star rookie cards, but most of the other ones, for a long time, I put in the plastic pages. But a couple years ago, as I'm continuing to add to the vintage part of my collection, I'm sitting there thinking, why do I have so many 77, 78, 79 tops common cards, some of them in, let's just say, like PSA 4 condition or worse in a lot of cases. I'm wondering, why do I have these in plastic pages? It doesn't make much sense because the age, the condition, the fact that they're commons, they're worth like 6 cents a piece. Why would I put a 78 tops common card in the same plastic page as I would for a star or rookie card? And in fact, with this card being valued at like 6 cents, it's only maybe twice the value of a random 1990 tops card that I would throw in there. And of course, I wouldn't put a common 1990 tops card in a plastic page. So I got to think, it's just like, you know, it doesn't make much sense because, again, there's not a whole lot of value to these particular cards other than just my own personal value. And I also want to save the plastic pages for the older cards that even the common cards need to be protected just to keep them in decent shape. But also, and I believe it was Keith Olbermann who inspired me to do this a couple years ago. I saw him post this on Twitter. You know, he's got a bunch of common cards from the 70s and they're just sitting in a collector's box. Now, Keith Olbermann makes far more money than I make. And he also is on the board for the Topps baseball card company, or Topps sports cards, whatever they're called, the Topps company. He's an advisor, I believe, so he certainly has access to a lot more cards, and he certainly has a lot more access to money to buy older cards than I do. But still, I thought about it, I'm like, you know, these cards in the 70s, they were pretty much designed to be handled and to be put in a box and to be looked through. So A couple years ago, I started taking all those 76 through 80 cards out of the plastic sleeves, and I just put them in a box. Now, I still have the plastic sleeves for 1975 and before. And again, because of the age of the cards, even if they are common cards and even if they aren't in perfect condition, I like to keep those protected because they're getting older. And you need to keep them in decent shape. Of course, some of the cards from the 1950s, if you just leave them out, you know, eventually they soak up sunlight and smell like whatever room they're in, and eventually will just fall apart. And obviously, I don't want that. So I still protect the 75 and prior cards in the plastic sleeves. But for me, if it's a common card from 1976 to 1980, I just throw it in the box, and there it is. And I had my shoebox moment earlier this week after talking to our guest, an author who has penned a lot of articles for Rolling Stone magazine, several books as well. But the two books that stand out that you've probably read, or at least are aware of, and I highly recommend you do read both of them. One came out several years ago. It's called Big Hair and Plastic Grass. And that's a look at Major League Baseball and America in the 1970s. And then, to refine the 70s even more, a book that came out just 3 or 4 years ago called Stars and Strikes focuses on 1976, America's bicentennial year, and a big year for the author, Dan Epstein. Now, he will tell you why 1976 was the prime focus because of not only events happening in Major League Baseball and events happening in America at the time, but also events in his personal life. 1976 was a big, big year for him as a young man and as a sports fan, as a hobbyist as well. That was the year he started collecting baseball cards. And even though this was more than 40 years ago, you could still see the effects of that summer of 76, if you will, as he was able to write a book about it. So after talking to Dan Epstein and having this box of cards in front of me, I decided, okay, what we're going to do with this episode is I'm going to take this 800-count box of cards that's almost full. There's probably about 730 or 740 cards in there. And I'm going to pull one card from 76, one card from 77, one card from 78, one card from 79. And just in case, you know, I pull a player that doesn't have much of a story or I can't find much information about, I'll pull one from 1980 as well. And those five players are very interesting players that we're going to get to after our interview with Dan Epstein. But here I am looking at this box of cards. And keep in mind, every time I go out to a card show, I always find, you know, the $8 for $1 box or the, $2 for $1, $3 for $1, $3 for $5 boxes. And they are often cards from the 1960s and 70s that are maybe that PSA 3 or 4 grade, but you get them at great values. Or as I call them, as we did several episodes ago, the strays. You know, that's where I find that 1970 Topps Reggie Jackson. That's where I find that 58 Topps, you know, Brooks Robinson or Harmon Killebrew was one that I found. Those are the boxes that I find some real gems in. Recently, a 74 Topps Tom Seaver, $2.50. And okay, so it wasn't PSA 10, but you know what? For $2.50, I get an early career card of Tom Terrific. I mean, how cool is that? So, you know, I'm looking through all these boxes all the time, and I've always got my hands on these older cards, and I'm always purchasing these at discount prices. But there was just something special about opening up that 800-count box a few days ago and just pulling the cards out and just thumbing right through them and just looking at them and looking at the players, looking at the uniforms, looking at the designs of the cards. I've always loved 76 and 77 and 78 Tops. 79 and 80, not so much, but they're still memorable sets. I still collect a lot of them. And just going through these cards, I was just traveling back in time. All right, how did I get this card? When was the first time I opened a 77 Tops pack? Here's a card that I got from that 800 card lot at that dealer for only $40. He's just trying to clear out these old cards. So it was a lot of fun going through all of these cards. And I'm Also, as I'm going through these cards, I'm wondering, what was my criteria for deciding what goes in the box and what goes in the plastic pages? Because as I'm thumbing through these, I find a 77 Topps Gary Carter. It's in the box. I'm like, wait a minute. Did I make a mistake here? What had me determine that the 77 Carter was not good enough to get the plastic page experience? So I left it in the box. I'm going to have to look at it again. At least maybe I could put one of those soft plastic sleeves on it and put it back in the box if I don't have a plastic page or a hard top loader to put it in. But I just had those shoebox memories, if you will, as I was going through that box. And it ties in rather nicely, again, with the five players that we're going to talk about after the interview, and of course our interview with Dan Epstein in just a few moments. Now, first, I want to reset like we always do. Wax Ecstatic comes your way every other Friday, and it drops on Fridays at noon Eastern via Audio Boom and is transmitted everywhere across the world via the RSS feed. You can find us on Apple Podcasts as well as iTunes, or excuse me, that is Apple Podcasts. Apple Podcasts along with iHeartRadio. I knew there was an I in there. iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Stitcher, Blueberry, also Google Play and Spotify. We are everywhere. And if you haven't told your friends, whether they collect now or collected back in the day, share the program with them. And make sure, too, that if you are listening on a platform that allows you to rate and comment on the show, such as Apple Podcasts, please do. And be honest, but obviously the better ratings we get, the higher ratings we get, and the more comments we get, not only makes me feel all warm and fuzzy inside, but it also helps bump the podcast up in the algorithm just a little bit. You get a lot of positive feedback, and Apple Podcasts will help promote the show from within and expose us to some new listeners. So again, if you haven't rated us yet, please do. Share the show with your friends and family members and other collectors, and just let them know that it comes your way every 2 weeks, Fridays at noon Eastern. Now, of course, we also have our archives up there. We've had, I think, over 140 shows now dating back to the summer of 2016. So you are easily accessible to those podcasts, and we encourage you to listen to them. Again, our Twitter feed is at Wax and Gum Stains. That is open 24/7. And we had a very interesting comment from our last podcast. We'll get to that in a moment. But as I'm talking about the Audio Boom home base, and as I'm talking about archives, I do want to put out one more plea. If you have a few extra bucks hanging around, please consider making a cash donation to Wax Ecstatic. You can do so via our PayPal page. That is paypal.me/waxecstatic. All one word there, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And your money helps out this program in one of two ways. One, it helps us basically keep the podcast going, keeps the archives up and free, I should add. I could, if I wanted to, take the first 120 shows, if I wanted to, and slap a $2.99 per episode fee to it. I might have to do that one day, but I'd rather not. So it helps keep everything operating and free for everybody. But also, your donations go to the purchase of the products that we discuss on this program and any excess products. So, for example, if I buy a box of 1990 Topps and open it up on the show, if we have any extra cards, we put them into several donation boxes, and those boxes will go to one of two nonprofit organizations. The next box will go to Kidority Cards, and the next shipment after that, probably several months from now, will be going to Commons for Kids. And Commons for Kids picked up about 3,000 cards that we donated from, some cards from the 1970s going all the way up through 2019 releases. So again, those excess products go to Commons for Kids and Kidority Cards, two great operations, and you are more than welcome to check them out. Just type it into Google, Commons for Kids, excuse me, and Kidority Cards, Kidority Cards with a K, to great groups of people that help pass along the hobby to youngsters. Those who have a few bucks and who want a monthly package of cards from their favorite team. That's what Kidorty Cards does. And those who may not have the money, and in fact, maybe down on their luck, maybe they're dealing with some kind of an illness or recovering from an injury, have to go through several surgeries. The Commons for Kids will take all these baseball cards, old and new, package them up and send them out to kids through charities and at hospitals and children's care centers and organizations such as that. So it's great that we're able to, you know, kind of, you know, through a back channel, able to provide all of this card content to the next generation of collectors. Now, as I was talking about at Wax and Gum Stains on our Twitter feed, we were talking in our last show, and I thought it was the strangest thing. We were talking about those shoebox dreams. I said, you know, I didn't have a shoebox per se when I started. I had a Velveeta cheese box, and I just thought it was the strangest thing. We even tagged Velveeta in a tweet about it. And the people who were running the Velveeta Twitter account actually liked it and put a hashtag TBT for Turn Back the Clock, or Throwback Thursday, I should say. And it was nice that they acknowledged that. But what was also interesting was the reality that I wasn't the only nerd who was putting baseball cards in a Velveeta cheese box. In fact, Mike Summer started the whole conversation. He says, I think Wax and Gum Stains and I may be long-lost cousins. Well, we are both balding, as I look at your picture here, Mike. It is possible. You say, were we the only ones who used Velveeta boxes to store cards? I still do. And he sends this picture of, let me see, 6 Velveeta boxes. Now, without the tops, it's just the bottom of the box. And he's got pack upon pack upon pack of cards in there. And that is absolutely awesome. And thankfully, Mike, we discovered that we were not the only people who were storing cards in the Velveeta boxes. In fact, let me see. Robbie T86, also known as Booby Mame, mentioned that he once ordered a lot of cards off eBay. They were shipped in a butter box, which is roughly the same as a Velveeta box. Unfortunately, the cards were damaged. Yeah, I wouldn't actually ship in a Velveeta box. Maybe if I'm just storing them for myself or I'm using them for display, but I definitely wouldn't ship there. We had several other people who said that they did it, including Cardboard Icons, also Suspicious Cat. We also had Shane C. say, great idea, time to buy some cheese. Well, if you need an excuse to buy cheese, I guess that's one way you could do it. Christopher Casilli saying, great life hack. And Kevin Kim's replying, nope, I remember this being my mom's solution to keeping our cards in one place. It's a very smart mother of yours. And let's see, who else here? Oh, Fred Harris says, I still do. Klondike boxes work well too. And Shane Katz also chiming in on the Velveeta cheese discussion by saying, I used these as a kid too. Still have several in use. And somebody else brought up a comment about using cheese boxes. Michael Rathburn says, government cheese boxes for me. Let me tell you what, government cheese just does not get the credit that it is due. If you've ever had true government cheese, and I'm talking like the C ration army can, the number 10 can with like 5 gallons of white cheese sauce in it, you just have not lived life. So there you go. More people using the cheese boxes, be it Velveeta or government cheese, or we had some suggestions for Klondike bars and the unfortunate shipping in a butter box. But there are numerous ways to store your cards other than the tried and true traditional hobby cardboard boxes. So thanks everybody for all of your input on that. Also got a great comment from Dustin Seaton. Says, just got caught up on all 141 episodes. Well, God bless you, Dustin. I'm glad that you did. Great shows. Thank you. $28 at a garage sale. Cheap fun. And he sends a picture with, there's a box of 86 tops, or is a box that's labeled 86 tops. Now, I'm just guessing that that's like a complete set or starter set. But also, he has 5 wax boxes, 89 tops. He's got 2 of those, and 89 Donruss, 88 score, and one of my favorites, totally underrated, 91 Bowman. And a lot of these have those vintage price tags. Remember when we did the Top Stadium Club, the 93 Series 1 box a few weeks ago? And I mentioned that Target, and I think Walmart did it too, but I definitely know Target did. Target bought excess boxes from wholesalers and other retailers, and in fact, maybe some from the factory. And they stored them away, and in the late 90s, they put a vintage price tag on them and basically resold these old baseball cards. Well, you've got the vintage price tags on not only both of the 89 Topps boxes, they were reselling those for $9.99, the 89 Donruss box for $9.99, the 88 Score somehow was going for $11.99, I'm not sure how that happened, and the 91 Bowman. Now, it doesn't have the vintage price on it, but somebody did put a couple of price stickers. One says $9.99, just over the right arm of Fred McGriff as he is staring back at you in his brand new Padres uniform on that brand new Bowman card. And then there's a clearance tag, $5.50. So somebody was selling boxes of 91 Bowman for $5.50. I would take you up on that. I'd buy a couple of those if I could. But anyways, that's five complete wax boxes, unopened, as well as that 86 Topps. Again, I'm assuming it's a set. $28, so you're essentially paying $5.50 per box of cards there. That is the best of all worlds right there. When you can get some, I hate saying junk wax, but it's from that era. When you've got box and box and box of 89s and 88s and some 91s and this 86 Topps box, when you can get your hands on cheap cards like that, and as Dustin says, cheap fun, that's exactly what it is. That's exactly what we're trying to get across in a lot of these look back at cards here. It's great that you were able to take advantage of that at a particular garage sale. Good find by you. Now, speaking of good finds, again, the books Big Hair and Plastic Grass or Stars and Strikes are great finds for baseball fans, fans of America in the 1970s, if you're a history buff, or if you just like good stories. Well, our guest has plenty of good stories, not just in those books, but also in a conversation I had with him earlier this week. Dan Epstein is a fan of the program, follows us on Wax and Gum Stains, and if you don't follow him, you should follow him because he's got all sorts of thoughts about specifically 1970s baseball stuff. And we talk a little bit about that, about the hobby today, and the summer of 76. He wrote a book about it, and there are a lot of reasons why that summer was important, not just then, but 43 years later. The effects of things that happened in Major League Baseball are still reverberating through the sport today. So from earlier this week, here's my conversation with Dan Epstein. Welcome to Wax Ecstatic. I'm so glad that you could join us for a few minutes today.
Oh, hey, man. Thanks for having me.
So I like to know how people get started in the hobby, the collecting, you know, somebody who follows this show or listens to it. You're equally, if not more than a nerd than I am. So I always like to get to know what's the backstory. What got you interested in baseball cards back then? And are you still an occasional collector today?
Well, let me answer the first part of your or second part of your question first. No, I'm not. I actually really only collected hardcore for about four seasons, 76 through 79. After that, money pretty much started going towards records instead of baseball cards, and that's where it goes today. Although, you know, every once in a while, like some friends stopped in on their way to somewhere else a few weeks ago, stayed overnight at my house, and they brought me an entire box of 19. Let me see. I still got it here. It's Topps, entire 1990 Topps set. Now, which I really appreciate. I mean, I thought it was a very lovely gift, but it's also like, you know, cool thing. You know, it's not like I know that's not a particularly valuable year, and you know, I really don't. You know, I'll probably go through it and pick out some of my favorite Tigers or something. But I don't go looking for baseball cards these days.
I got to tell you, first of all, once you pull your Tigers cards out, send me the rest because I'm hand collating that set, and that'll save me several bucks on random garage sale wax packs that I find. But yeah, I have to mention, even though I liked the 1990 set, you're right. You know the value of it, and having your friends kind of toss that on you while crashing at your place, it's like, you know, the gas station birthday card. It's just like, oh yeah, you thought of me at the last second. Which flea market did you find this at, and where'd you find the $5 to buy it?
Exactly, I believe it was exactly $5, and yeah, I think a Duraflame log probably is more expensive than the whole Topps box, but you know, whatever. You know, I mean, I still think baseball cards are fun. I really got into it in '76, which was my first year of baseball fandom, and actually the story behind my first baseball cards is a fun one because it was April '76. I went to a friend's house for his birthday party, and it was going to be a sleepover where we all went to see a movie first, and the movie was The Bad News Bears, which had just been released, which is still my favorite baseball film of all time. And then our party favors were every kid got five wax packs of 1976 Topps cards. And I had never had a baseball card before. This was, you know, I had never really been that into baseball before I was 10. So I was just like starting to, you know, become aware. And this, you know, this party favor was definitely the best party favor I ever got because it completely sent me down the road of, you know, being a baseball nerd. And, you know, I remember like looking at the numbers on the back and the stats and having no idea what any of it meant. So I took the cards home the next day, showed them to my dad. He told me how to read them. He, you know, kind of told me, you know, what a double was, what a triple was, and you know, what a batting average was. And, you know, and then I could see on the back of the card that there were stats from previous seasons. And that made me think, okay, there's a historical aspect to baseball, and which I had never really thought about before. And you know, before I was into baseball, I was really a history nerd. I was really into the American Revolution and the Civil War. So I had this light bulb moment where it's like, oh, you can think about baseball in the same way, where it's like there's important games, there are important moments in history. Players did this, players were on this team, they're on that team, they wore this uniform, they wore that uniform. And I was off and running from that point. I you know, by the end of 1976, like I knew more about baseball than anyone in my class. I was just so obsessed. And that's what got me started.
You know, it's a similar story. And first of all, regarding your comment about 90 Topps being cheaper than a Duraflame log, when you set a 90 Topps factory set on fire, the smell of the bubblegum and cardboard, it's much more attractive to card collectors. But I digress. But, you know, your story is similar to mine and to a lot of people, too. I was, I think, 11 when I got my first cards. And it was the exact same thing where it's just like I'd known about them. My older brother had, you know, lightly collected some, but you know, until I had them in my own hands, it all pulled in my casual observation for sports, my love for history and numbers and being able to collect stuff. And like you, you know, it was a 4 or 5 year wheelhouse. You just went down that rabbit hole, and you know, part of you is still very much there. Now, Dan, did you grow up in Michigan? You mentioned you were a Tigers fan. Am I on with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you are correct. I was, and actually three of those baseball card collecting years were while I was living in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And then the fourth one, 1979, I had moved to Los Angeles. So, you know, in both Ann Arbor and LA, I had my, you know, I had my local drugstore where I would go and buy the cards, and you know, and I would wait chomping at the bit for the, you know, that first time in the spring. spring or, you know, or end of winter when the cards would finally appear on the racks, and that was just a glorious day.
Oh, yeah. It was something you could set your calendar to. Like, you knew, all right, spring training starts around here, and it's right around then that the first cards would roll out and into the stores. Now, let me ask you, too, about 1976, and we'll get into the book Stars and Strikes in a little bit, but for you, so this baseball card collecting time comes up then. You're living in Ann Arbor, Michigan at the time. You're a Tigers fan. How much did the summer of 76, the summer of the bird, Mark Fidrich, play into this wonderful puzzle of collecting the cards and having this long-term bond with the sport? It all just seems like it all came together that year for you.
Oh, absolutely. I'm so, like, I never got to see Fidrich pitch in person. We would go to a handful of Tigers games a year, but, like, the idea of, like, actually syncing up a visit to Tiger Stadium with, you know, knowing when Fidrich was going to pitch, like, that never really computed for my dad. So, you know, we just went when we went and saw who we saw, and didn't get lucky enough to see the bird in action. But, you know, we saw him on TV. You know, I listened to Ernie Harwell every night on the radio. It was such, I'm so glad I got to live through that and experience that, because it was, you know, I was coming into the game, and, you know, the Tigers were the first team I ever saw. Tiger Stadium was the first ballpark I ever went to on a major league level. And, you know, and I was aware that, A, the Tigers had a long and often glorious history, but, B, they were coming off really one of the worst seasons in their history, 75. And so, like, you know, the popular saying around my elementary school was, Tigers suck, because, of course, they did, and much as they do today. And so when Fidrich shows up, you know, we're all, you know, 10-year-old children of Watergate, essentially. Mm-hmm. We're all cynical as hell. We all, you know, don't believe anything that's told to us on TV because, you know, it's got to be a lie. And so Fidrich shows up and starts, you know, pitching amazingly well, but also, like, is attracting all this attention for his antics. And so my friends and I are all like, he's a fake. He's just doing that for attention. You know, we just, like, did not buy into it at all. And I remember, like the angriest I think my father ever got with me was when he overheard me saying that to another friend. You know, just like, oh, Fidrich is a fake. And he just, like, took me aside. He's like, oh, so you know it all, right? You can't just, like, take this for what it is. And you know, and I kind of stomped off fuming. But then it was probably about 4 weeks later that the Monday night game against the New York Yankees happened. And I was actually not in Michigan at the time. I was visiting my grandparents in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Roll Tide! Woo!
Roll Tide, yeah. My grandfather literally lived two houses away from Bear Bryant. We had
Excellent.
To run into him on his evening constitutionals. But we watched the game, and it was, you know, I think that was the first time I really understood how magical Mark Fidrich was, because, you know, not only did I see it with my own eyes, but I could see it through the eyes of the announcers, through the people just going nuts at Tiger Stadium, and then, of course, him, you know, shutting down the Yankees, who were great that year, and so at that point I became, you know, I dropped my cynicism, I embraced the bird, and for the rest of the summer, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, he was, you know, with me and my friends, he was as cool as the Fonz and Peter Frampton put together. That fall, one of the kids in my class comes in and starts bragging that he's got a bird card, and we're like, you know, no way that like, you know, is Topps making these? What's you know, was this like a last minute thing? How you know, this is a Burger King card? Like where did you get this? Really? And you know, so we told him to bring it in, and it was a 1976 Doug Bird card. So it was just like, oh man, you're.
But a bird card nonetheless.
Yes, he was correct in that sense, but it wasn't the bird card we were all hoping for.
Dan Epstein joining us here on Wax Ecstatic. One more question about your fandom before we talk a little bit about the history window that you often cover. So you're a Tigers fan, but I also read that when you needed to pick a National League team to cheer for, you cheered for the Cubs.
That is correct. Well, here's what actually happened. So 79, I moved to L.A., and my mom had been living out there for a couple of years, so I moved out there with her. And whenever I'd go visit her, we would go to Dodger games. So the Dodgers were my NL team for the 70s, for the second half of the 70s. When they played in the World Series against the Yankees, I rooted for the Dodgers, you know. And this is, you know, still in the era where there were two distinct, discrete leagues, and, you know, you would never have the Tigers playing the Dodgers except in spring training. So, you know, picking a team in each league was a fun way to kind of like get into what was happening in those leagues. But in late 79, my mom married a guy who lived in Chicago, and so we upped stakes and moved to Chicago. Now, at that point, I was seriously considering trading in my Tigers fandom for the White Sox.
Wow.
Because I loved Bill Veeck so much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would read articles about him, and I just thought, like, his attitude, his, you know, intelligence, his take on, you know, the game and life and everything, just like this, you know, at the age of 13, Bill Veeck was my guru. So I just thought, like, well, I'm going to Chicago, I got to pull for the White Sox. But then we landed in Chicago, and we wound up living on the north side, and it was a pain in the ass to get down to Comiskey from the north side of Chicago. And then I wound up going to high school just a mile south down Clark Street from Wrigley Field. So in those days, you know, we're talking early 80s, you could show up at Wrigley, like, after the sixth inning, and they would just wave you in. Like, you know, there were so few people in the ballpark, you know, they were hoping maybe you'd come in and buy a hot dog or something and they could make a little money off you. So I saw the tail end of so many Cubs games just because they were on my way home. And so you know, you go enough times and you just, you know, I loved Wrigley Field, and as bad as the Cubs were, and they were awful in the early 80s. You know, I just kind of got sucked into it. And again, there was so much history there, and, you know, so much of the culture, the city's culture revolved around the sports teams. And, you know, I just thought, like, well, all right, Cubs are going to be it.
Because I was thinking, you know, you could be a Dodgers fan or Phillies or Cardinals, but the Cubs, you know, it paid off eventually. You got some playoff appearances in 84 and 89, of course, the World Series a few years ago. But, you know, that story about you catching Cubs games on your way home from school, it just brings back the great Lee Elia tirade. 85% of the world works here. The other 15% come here.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, you know, I didn't have a job. I was
you were a Cub fan. You were unemployed. You were perfect for the Cubs then. Yeah.
Exactly. And so, you know, so when the Cubs, of course, when the Cubs got good, you know, or times through the years where they would get good, you know, there were always accusations flying around of, like, you know, who was a bandwagon fan, who was a Johnny Come Lately. And, you know, I always said, like, look, I started rooting for the Cubs in 1980. Like, you cannot tell me I'm a fair weather Cubs fan.
Yeah, you remember the baby blue pajama road jerseys that they used to wear back then?
That's... Oh, which I still love. I don't have a lot of jerseys, but one of the few, I think I've got two Cubs jerseys, and one of them is a blue pajamas Bruce Sutter one with the white pinstripes against the blue background, and I still think that's, you know, that's such a unique uniform, and I love it.
And if you have a shaggy head, it fits you well, absolutely, if you got the Sutter 1980 look going on there.
Yeah, which I don't anymore, but for a long time. But when I did, it worked very well.
People probably asked you for autographs, right? Hey, it's Bruce Sutter!
Exactly. Wow, Bruce Sutter's only 5'8".
Yeah. Well, you know what they say. TV puts 10 pounds and about 4 inches on you, I believe.
True.
All right. Dan Epstein joining us here on Wax Ecstatic. And Dan, let's look back to 1976 a little bit. You wrote a book about it, Stars and Strikes, and not just about the 1976 baseball season, but also about not just baseball in America, but obviously American politics, society. Like you said, you were writing that, rather, how shall we put it, the sarcastic Watergate generation that's growing up here. What made 1976, of all the baseball years in the 1970s, what made 1976 jump out so much at you that you had to write a book about it?
Well, a couple things. One was the Mark Fidrich aspect of it and the magic that he really brought to the game. But there were a couple of other things. One was that 1976 was the first year of full-scale free agency. And actually, there was a lockout at the beginning of the season where the owners locked the players out until they would, bend to their will in terms of the basic agreements, they called it, in terms of contracts and what free agency would mean, and that really struck me as very interesting that it happened in 1976, because 1976 was the 200th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence, which is, America's 200th birthday. So here you have players, essentially fighting for their freedom as individual players, but also collectively, so that they're not stuck playing for the same team for the rest of their life, so that they can actually, after their contractual time is up with a certain team, they can offer their services to the highest bidder. And the juxtaposition of their fight for their freedom with the celebration of America's fight for freedom and during the Revolution, that was very interesting to me. And it was also very interesting because, at the same time that Americans were going nuts with bicentennial fever, painting everything red, white, and blue, and any excuse to light off some more firecrackers and dress up and celebrate. By and large, the American public's reaction to what the players were doing was very negative. It's like they couldn't see the connection, between one kind of freedom and the other. It was just like, oh, these players are taking for granted that they're playing a kid's game, and they're already making more money than we are. Like, how dare they? And we expect our favorite players to be on our favorite teams for their entire career, and this is messing with baseball tradition. And so that was very interesting to me to see how close-minded the average American sports fan was when it came to this very important subject.
Yeah, people forget, especially with the old clauses in contracts, that once you signed that first contract, and sometimes it was when you were 16 years old, or in some cases younger, if somebody could predict your superstar status, you were tied to that team for life until they wanted to cut you or trade you. So, I don't like to use a phrase like servitude or anything like that, because that's a little too harsh. But how would you like it if somebody signed you as a teenager and didn't pay you more than the minimum, even if you were a superstar? People forget Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays and so many great players hardly made more than their market value or anywhere close to it, just because there was that. Again, servitude is such a tough word, but there was that agreement amongst the owners, and the best players didn't get paid a ton of money. So you're right. It's an absolute opportunity for freedom that they experienced in 76. And it was the winter of 76. And we actually did a podcast on this not too long ago about the 77 top set. talking about the airbrush jobs. And, you know, I after looking through everything and combining the expansion of 77 along with the free agency, and you had some pretty big names moving around then, I calculated, I think Topps had to airbrush like 120 cards. It was like a fifth of their set, because you had to create Blue Jays, you had to create Mariners, and then you had to, you know, put a sloppy looking Angels hat on Don Baylor's head. And, you know, they just had to make do. But that was a turning point in the game. And the players who are making $30 million contracts now, you know, you have to tip your cap to those guys over 40 years ago who finally, after a long process, made it play through for them, and they were able to get paid for what their value was.
Exactly. And I really, you know, and I think that people tend to forget, you know, how we got, you know, with any historical events, you know, people tend to forget what happened to get us to the place where we are now. And so really, you can argue, and I do in Stars and Strikes, that what happens in 76, you know, really changed the game forever economically, and, you know, for better or worse, but it's, you know, 76 is where it all happened. 76 is where players stopped having to work other jobs in the off season to make ends meet. You know, 76 is where players, you know, start to, you know, be able to go, hey, I'm not happy with how I'm being treated by this team, by this owner, by this manager, and my contract is up at the end of the season, so I'm going to walk, you know, and I'm going to see what's out there. And then this is where you get, like, George Steinbrenner turning the Yankees into what they are today, where it's like, you know, the constant, willingness to throw big money at guys that they think are really going to make a difference. And, you know, and other teams, too, have done that, of course, through the years. But you know, Steinbrenner did it with definitely a no-holds-barred attitude. And the other thing, too, I mean, 76 is important. To talk about another team that wasn't very good in 76 but made a big impression, you know, over the next couple of decades, was the Atlanta Braves.
Mm-hmm.
And 76 is where Ted Turner buys the team and really transforms that team's fortunes. And with a very genius outlook, where he knows that the team is going to be bad for several seasons to come. So he's going to not only engage in the kind of Bill Vick, Charlie Finley hucksterism, where you know, just toss out every kind of crazy promotion imaginable to get people down to the ballpark, but he also he has a TV station, WTCG, which later becomes TBS, and he has the vision to understand that by putting his team on his station every night, he's expanding the audience for the team. He's expanding the fan base. And at that time, that was, you know, most owners would have rather, you know, cut off a foot than televise more than 10 or 20 of their team's games in a season, because the standard wisdom was that if you televise your team's games, people won't come out to the ballpark to see your team. But with Turner, it was the opposite. He knew that by broadcasting his team out to, you know, out to Tennessee, out to Alabama, out to North Carolina, that he would make the Braves kind of a destination team where people would come from all over to come see his ball club play and buy their merchandise et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's, you know, and that all happened in 76, or started to happen in 76 too. So I felt that was a very interesting turning point in baseball history that doesn't really get the appreciation it should.
Oh, yeah, especially because it's a whole new revenue stream. And with the arrival of cable television and, of course, the early days of satellite television, when you had to have one of those giant 60-inch dishes outside of your house to have satellite TV. But it was great timing on Turner's part. And, you know, growing up here in Florida,
You know, the Rays have been around since 1998, but we fight, as it's well known, you know, there's lots of Yankee fans and Cub fans and Red Sox fans, right, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, that's from a lot of people who moved down here. But a big reason why it took a long time for the Rays fan base to solidify and grow is because for 20 years before, you had Braves games, you had Cubs games, you had Mets games on, you know, the superstations, basically following Ted Turner's model. And, right, you know, creating fan bases everywhere. And by the way, while I'm here to promote your books, too, I do want to throw out there is a book that Bob Hope, not the actor, but the former promotions director for the Braves, put out in the, I want to say, 1990. It was called We Wouldn't Have Finished Last With You, I believe is what it's called. We couldn't have won with you.
We could have finished last without you.
There we go. We could have finished last without you. Thank you. Yeah. And basically, he was the promotions director from like 66 to 80, 81, somewhere around there. And boy, he had to pull rabbits out of his hat. And then you got Ted Turner, the ultimate huckster, coming in. But knowing how to put on a show, it's very entertaining reading. So good I forgot the title, but it is definitely a good book.
Yeah, I definitely, that was one I definitely pulled off the shelf while writing Stars and Strikes, because Bob Hope's stories are amazing, and staying with my grandparents in Tuscaloosa, I got to watch a lot of those Braves games as well, and as terrible as the Braves were, at least you were watching Major League Baseball on TV every night, which, you know, we forget how unusual that was. I mean, nowadays, you have the package, you can watch any game, but then it was like, you were lucky if you got to see two or three games a week.
Yeah, if you didn't have one of those superstation options, or if you didn't live in a region like Alabama that you got the Braves games, your only baseball exposure, period, if you weren't in a Major League Baseball market, was the Sunday game of the week on NBC, and starting in 1976, Monday Night Baseball on ABC. Yeah. That was pretty much it. Well, Dan, let me ask you just a couple more questions. I know you have to run here. When we look at the 1970s, so as you mentioned, 1976, a very pivotal year in baseball for numerous reasons. But when you kind of go up and down the scale, you see artificial turf, you see more domed stadiums, you see the classic polyester double knit jerseys, which because of color TV, teams had to jazz up their uniforms to stand out more. Of course, the designated hitter rule in 1973 with the American League. Baseball was falling on hard times in the late 60s, and these were different ways that owners and broadcast partners and everybody else tried to inject some life and some energy into the game. You're seeing a lot of that now. Of course, we've got countdown clocks and, changing the size of the September call-up roster and number of pitchers you can call from the bullpen, and even a boneheaded idea. Let's start the 10th inning with a runner on second. You know, all these crazy ideas to try to get it going again. Do you see parallels between the quote-unquote problems with baseball now compared to, say, 40, 45 years ago?
Well, on a very general level, yes. But I think, you know, the game is so different now on so many levels. And I think, you know, in the 1970s, when the teams were, you know, monkeying with these various ideas like designated hitter, the team's main source of revenue was people coming to the ballpark. And that's not the case anymore. Now it's so much about cable rights and licensing and all this stuff. So it's kind of like, I feel that's sort of like symbolic to like how the fan is getting kind of separated from the game, because it's this sort of like generic fan that they're trying to play to with, like, oh, we need to speed the game up. Of course, then we also need to have replays which slow the game down. It seems like there's not a lot of the average fan can't afford to go to see baseball in person with the frequency that the average fan could in the 1970s. And I think that's being kind of forgotten by these teams and by the commissioner's office as they struggle to come up with new ideas, new things to, make baseball exciting. The other thing is there are, when you say baseball was falling on hard times in the 60s and early 70s, I mean, it was to a degree, but there was also not a whole lot of competition. I mean, it was like what that meant was that the NFL was becoming more popular than Major League Baseball, which had never happened before. But there were still people coming out to the ballpark, and in fact, if you look at the attendance totals from 1970 to 1979, they, ballooned by the end of the 70s. It's the Dodgers become the first team to draw over 3 million fans in a season. Attendance definitely picks up. But nowadays, attendance is quite literally dropping, and there's so much other competition for the entertainment dollar. It's not just movies. It's not just, TV and video games. I mean, there's just so many other things for people, young people especially, to get distracted by and to care about more than baseball. Baseball can implement all these changes, but the change they really need to implement is making it more affordable to go to a game, because that experience will do a lot more to make fans than, speeding up, starting a guy on second, mm-hmm. and getting him home to end the game quicker.
Yeah, you're right. It just seems like so many ideas are just thrown against the wall. But at the same time, some players and management and season ticket holders will complain, well, geez, the Rays are selling this whole section. It's $2 a seat. Well, I'm like, well, it got you a couple thousand people to see the Orioles on a Tuesday night. It, brings some noise to the stadium. I'm all for that. Now, that, by the way, that can be an entirely different show, and I think I may do that at some point in time. But let me wrap with this, Dan. We talked about some of your past literature works. Anything in the works now that you've been putting pen to?
Well, two things I want to mention. One is that Big Hair and Plastic Grass finally came out in an audiobook.
Nice.
This summer. So you can find that wherever audiobooks are streaming or are downloaded or are sold. And So that's pretty exciting, and I actually got to do the narration for it, so you get to hear my dulcet tones taking you through the seasons of 1970 through 1979. And I've been also working on a project, still kind of up in the air, but I've been collaborating with Ron Bloomberg. You mentioned the DH. Ron's cleats and bat are in the Hall of Fame because he was the first player to make an official at-bat, plate appearance in a major league game as a designated hitter. So he's a really interesting character in and of itself. But the book we're working on is about his friendship with Thurman Munson, because he and Munson were actually best friends and spent a lot of time living together and rooming together during the time with the Yankees. And Thurman was really the person that Ron leaned on when Ron's career ended, unfortunately, rather quickly due to a variety of injuries. And Thurman was really the guy who kept supporting him through it all, even when he was still on the Yankee payroll, like 2 years after his last at bat with the team. And he has a number of just amazing Thurman stories and hilarious, and that really show you a side of the guy that you don't get. That I didn't know. That a lot of people just think of him as this gruff guy who was kind of a hard nosed player, which he was. But he was also a real, a sweetheart, a prankster, and you know, and a true friend when the chips were down. And so we're shopping the proposal around. We've got a few nibbles. Nothing has been signed yet, but we're hoping that we can find a good publisher for that and put it out the next year or two.
Well, I certainly wish you the best of luck with that. Of course, Thurman's passing 40 years ago this past August, and a lot of stories coming out then, a lot of memories, chilling memories of that day when he died in the plane crash. And I'm sure hearing more than just what we see in the archive tapes or read in the books from 40 or so years ago should be very entertaining, and I hope we get to see that sooner than later. And I certainly thank you again for joining me and for talking about, in particular, 1976, but a lot of great baseball years, players, funkadelic uniforms, stadiums, all that stuff. And we're actually going to take a look at a few cards from my appropriately 1976 to 80 box. We'll just pull a few random ones here. But I really appreciate the time and for following along. And again, best of luck to everything you do moving forward. Dan Epstein joining us here on Wax Ecstatic.
Thanks so much, Matt. I really appreciate you reaching out and inviting me on. This was a blast.
It was a blast. Dan, thanks again for joining me. Dan Epstein, again, the author of Big Hair and Plastic Grass, a look at baseball in America in the 1970s, and Stars and Strikes, an in-depth look into 1976, not just the 1976 baseball season, but also life in America, the year of the bicentennial. All right, let's take a look at the five players that I pulled from that great box of 1976 through 80 Topps cards that I have. And we posted the video yesterday. If you go to YouTube, just type in Wax Ecstatic 1970s Break. That's what we called it, Wax Ecstatic 1970s Break. You'll find the video there. And you'll see me just open up this 800 card or 800 count box and just at random pull out one card from each 76, 77, 78, 79, and 80 tops. Well, our 76 tops card is of Dave May, who was with the Atlanta Braves at this particular juncture in his career. A native of Delaware, he was a star player at William Penn High School, and he was scouted out by both the San Francisco Giants and Philadelphia Phillies. Now, what is so funny is Dave May actually signed a contract with both the Giants and the Phillies, but he ended up becoming property of the Giants because their contract was received first by organized baseball. So he begins his professional career in the Appalachian League with the Salem Rebels, had a batting average of .379, won the batting title, but he would find himself in the Baltimore Orioles organization the following year. He's part of the 1962 first-year player draft and moved his way up through the Orioles farm system, part of many winning teams, including the Fox Cities Foxes in Appleton, Wisconsin, also the Tri-City Adams in Kennewick, Washington, and also the Rochester Red Wings in the International League. He would eventually make his debut in the major leagues in 1968. And was part of the American League champion Orioles in 1969, was platooned often, and this would be a story for much of Dave May's career, is that especially in the early days, he was stuck behind some great outfielders. Of course, Frank Robinson, but also Paul Blair. He had Merv Redmond, who was a good platoon outfielder, Don Buford. So May, even though he was with a really good team in the Orioles, they were going to win the World Series in 1970, he wouldn't be part of that World Championship team because in June of 1970, he was traded to the Milwaukee Brewers. In fact, the Brewers were visiting the Orioles, so May goes from the Orioles locker room to the Brewers locker room. And even though the Brewers were just an absolute train wreck in 1970, for Dave May, it was a great opportunity because he became a starting outfielder, and he did very well in Milwaukee. Starting center fielder for them, hit .240 in the remaining games of the 1970 season, but eventually became an all-star in 1973. Now, he stumbles out of the gate in 1974, has a bad case of the flu to start the season, really struggles at the plate, and even though defensively he was a good player, the Brewers need his bat, and he ends up hitting only .226 with 10 homers that year. So on November 2nd, 1974, Dave May, here's a great question for you trivia buffs. Now, he wasn't the only player involved in this deal. In fact, there was a minor league player, Roger Alexander, a pitcher, who went with May in this trade. But if you ever want to know who was Hank Aaron traded for, that's right, Dave May. As Aaron was aging, he had already broken Babe Ruth's home run record. The Braves were ready to move on from him. Milwaukee needed star power, and even though Hank Aaron was pretty much reduced to a first baseman slash designated hitter at this point in his career, it's still the home run champion, and it's a homecoming. Of course, Aaron playing for the Milwaukee Braves from 1953 to 1965. So Hank Aaron goes to Milwaukee, Dave May goes to Atlanta, and May thinks that, all right, I'm getting a brand new start all over again. But again, he's jammed up in an outfield logjam with the Atlanta Braves. And eventually, he gets traded to the Texas Rangers for Jeff Burrows. And once again, he's thinking, okay, I can now be a regular outfielder here with the Texas Rangers. He was mostly a platoon player, but did get some regular playing time with guys like Claudel Washington and Ken Henderson out due to injury. He was also a bit of a pest, as it turns out. In a notable game in 1977 between the Rangers and the Angels, Nolan Ryan, then pitching for the Angels, and who was dominant against Dave May, got under May's skin when May swung at a pitch and missed, and he swung so hard his contact lens fell out. So they're delaying the game so that May can crawl on his hands and knees and try to find this contact lens, and Ryan's just getting all upset, and he just says, you know, forget about it, I'm just going to strike you out anyway. So May's pretty pissed off, obviously, that Nolan Ryan's just calling him out on this. So May gets the bat boy to retrieve his glasses from the locker room. May puts the glasses on, and he strokes a double. And from second base, he's yelling at Ryan. He's like, is this a strikeout? And then just a few days later, against the Angels, it would be May's defense that would help the Rangers defeat the Angels, and in fact help Burt Blyleven get a no-hitter in Anaheim, Texas winning 6-0. He made a clutch waist-high catch in center field in the eighth inning to preserve that no-hitter. Now, as his career went on, he started dealing with a lot of injuries and then started bouncing around from team to team. He went back to the Milwaukee Brewers, also the Pittsburgh Pirates, had a tryout with the Philadelphia Phillies in 1979, but he was released. Instead of trying one more time in the major leagues, he decided to sign in the Inter-American League with Santo Domingo. Well, the league only lasted a few weeks, so it folded, pretty much his career folded, and that was about it. Now, he would later become a roving hitting instructor for the Atlanta Braves, and also was a big part in playing semi-pro ball with a lot of retired ball players, not just back in Delaware, but also they would make regular spring trips to Florida and would often take on teams like the Phillies and Clearwater. A lot of all-time great players playing on a team, as well as May, you know, kind of leading that way in these little exhibition games. Now, May had two boys who are involved in sports, and in baseball in particular. Dave Jr. was, and I believe still is, a professional scout for the Toronto Blue Jays. And Derek May, does that name ring a bell? Yeah, Derek May played a lot for the Cubs in the early 1990s, played for several teams in the 1990s, had a pretty long and productive career in the major leagues. Unfortunately, Dave May Sr. passed away in October of 2012 in Bear, Delaware at the age of 68 due to complications from diabetes. One more interesting thing about Dave May, even though Dave May is not in the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, his glove is, and it's not for anything that Dave May did. It's for something that one of his teammates did. The glove was actually worn by Brooks Robinson, but it is Dave May's glove. And apparently, according to May, Robinson had Rawlings as an equipment client, if you will. They gave him equipment. He was a spokesperson for him. And he just liked to try different pieces of equipment, and especially gloves. And he just had this fondness for broken-in gloves. He didn't like brand spanking new gloves. He had to have something that was a little loose, a little warm, a little broken in. And one time in the 1970 season, right before May got traded to Milwaukee, Brooksy apparently liked the glove that May was using. And he, borrowed the glove. May goes on to Milwaukee, and Robinson has another stellar year. And that memorable play at third base at Riverfront Stadium in the 1970 World Series, where Brooks Robinson, while getting pulled towards the third base line, and he picks up that ball and just wheels around midair and gets the throw over to first base in time for the out. That was Dave May's glove. So it was Brooks Robinson's highlight, but it was Dave May's glove that is in the Hall of Fame this day. Now, Earl Williams has a very similar story to Dave May, not just that they spent some time with the Atlanta Braves, but because Earl Williams got bounced around a little bit from team to team. And also, unfortunately for Williams, he had a massive chip on his shoulder. Part of it was his own fault. Part of it was circumstances from other people. One thing that is for sure is that when Williams had a grudge, he could not let it go. And that's unfortunate because he was a very talented player and even in some adverse situations was able to excel, but he just could not let this anger go whenever he got a little hot under the collar. Newark, New Jersey native Earl Craig Williams Jr. was a star player in American Legion ball. In fact, major league scouts from several teams are checking him out in the early 1960s. And eventually, the Milwaukee Braves would select Williams with their sixth overall first-round pick in the August phase of the 1965 draft. Now, he was a big fan of Hank Aaron, so this was going to be an absolute dream for him, right? Now, he was able to, thanks to the Braves, continue his college studies while playing professional ball in the minor leagues, and he eventually moves his way up to Atlanta in 1971. Now, throughout his career, now when he was playing American Legion ball, he was a pitcher. And in the minor leagues, he was playing first and third base. Well, when he gets up to Atlanta, you not only have Orlando Cepeda at first and Cleet Boyer at third, and a young Darrell Evans coming up through the system. Well, the Braves really don't have much room for him. They eventually cut ties with Boyer, who was complaining nonstop. So Williams would get a little time at third, and then when Cepeda needed some time off, he'd get a little time at first, but that was about it. Well, midway through the 1971 season, Lum Harris, the manager of the Braves, decides that he really wants Earl Williams' bat in the lineup, so he puts him behind the plate. Now, Williams never played catcher. He was not prepared. He never played the position in minor league or American Legion ball, but the starting catchers for the Braves, Hal King and Bob Didier, were weak hitters. Harris wants some pop in the lineup. He's got to use this kid somewhere, so he just puts him behind the plate. Well, while he was offensively a very talented player, defensively, he was just an absolute mess. And especially when you're trying to catch knuckleballs from Phil Niekro, you're not going to have a whole lot of luck. So even though Williams was the National League Rookie of the Year in 1971, it was definitely more for his pop and his bat than for his defensive play. There is no doubt about that. So he really struggled for the next couple of years, catching not just Niekro, but anybody in the Braves rotation. And remember what I said about having a chip on his shoulder. He just had this really dour mood, and he just did not enjoy his time in Atlanta. He came into spring training one year, 20 pounds overweight, and he would just basically use his bat to keep himself in the lineup. Well, eventually, the Braves just give up on Williams. Even though he could bring a lot of power to the plate, it just wasn't worth the headaches of dealing with an inexperienced catcher who once had 28 passed balls in one season, and also his bad attitude. So the Braves traded Williams to the Baltimore Orioles in a major deal. Williams and minor leaguer Taylor Duncan go to Baltimore for Dave Johnson, the second baseman, Johnny Oates, and pitchers Roark Harrison and Pat Dobson. And you would think the Orioles are like, great, we've got this powerful bat in our lineup here. Awesome. Not so much. In fact, Orioles players, including ace Jim Palmer, were publicly critical of the trade. They were blasting Williams before he even got there. Well, Williams was able to help Palmer have a solid 73 season. Palmer would actually win the American League Cy Young Award that year. But again, his attitude rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And he wasn't much of a fan favorite. Orioles fans liked Andy Etchebarren, who recently passed away, may he rest in peace, and also Alrod Hendricks. They didn't like Williams' attitude. Williams would sometimes get in fights with fans, you know, verbal fights, I should say, and just always played the role of the victim. And this would continue year after year. So while manager Earl Weaver is hoping that player Earl Williams can just bring his bat to the ballpark and not cause any problems and help the, you know, Orioles become consistent contenders, just doesn't work out that way. The Orioles players did not like him. The fans did not like him. The Orioles tried to move him. Nothing was successful. Finally, early in the 1975 season, they trade Williams back to the Braves, and they only got a minor league pitcher for him. So again, Williams is not going to be a catcher that much. He did appear behind the plate in several games, but the Braves are thinking, all right, let's move him at first base or you know, third base if Darrell Evans needs to sit out a game. Well, the Braves first baseman at the time, Mike Lum, who we're going to talk about in just a moment, didn't like Williams coming in. And once again, Williams had a grudge and he just couldn't let it go. And the 1976 season was pretty forgettable for the Atlanta Braves. So finally, Williams starts bouncing around. He's playing for the Oakland Athletics in 1977, nearly leads a player mutiny against manager Bobby Winkles in the 77 season. Eventually, in 1978, he gets injured in spring training. He was released by the A's several weeks later. And in the spring of 1978, after no team picks him up, Earl Williams actually takes an advertisement out in the New York Times. It said that he made $40,000 for the A's. He was in excellent health and had no police record. He put his mother's phone number on there for contact information because he didn't have his own phone. And the ad said, have bat, will travel, will hustle, surprisingly. There were no takers there, and he would bounce around in the Mexican League, also in the Pacific Coast League for a little bit, and that pretty much ended his professional career. Unfortunately, Earl Williams passing away in Somerset, New Jersey, back in January of 2013 due to leukemia. Now, our 1978 Topps card features a player we were just talking about, Mike Lum. Now, he wasn't with the Braves in 1978. He was actually with the Cincinnati Reds, one of a handful of players to make the major leagues after being born and raised in Hawaii. He was part of the Braves organization for a very, very, very long time. In fact, signed as a minor league free agent in the summer of 1963 by the Milwaukee Braves. And he was moving his way up through the Braves farm system and eventually becomes part of the Braves starting lineup in 1967. And he also not only has the rare opportunity, I guess I should say, or he not only has the rare trivial tidbit, let's put it that way, of being one of a handful of Hawaiian-born players to make it to the major leagues, he is also one of a handful of players to have pinch hit for Hank Aaron. And he may have been the first player to pinch hit for Hank Aaron, although nobody can really be sure, in 1968, as he pinch hit for Aaron in a 12-0 blasting of the New York Mets. And basically, the Braves had batted around, and Aaron looked at Mike Lum and basically just said, hey, you want a hit? And Lum Harris, the manager, just said, all right, Lum, go on out there. So it was one of the few times that Hank Aaron was actually pinch hit for on purpose in his career. He was a consistent force, Mike Lum was, for the Atlanta Braves. He continued to become more and more of a starter at first base, even though Lum would share some time at first base with Hank Aaron. But Also having to platoon with Ralph Garr and eventually the rather ineffective Sonny Jackson. So he spent a little time in the outfield, a little time at first base, but wherever he was a pretty productive player. Now, as Lum did not like playing alongside Earl Williams throughout 1976, Lum eventually got traded to Cincinnati for Daryl Chaney. By that point in time, Dave Concepcion, who we will talk about in a few minutes, was taking over the reins at shortstop in Cincinnati. So Chaney was available. Chaney goes to Atlanta. Lum goes to Cincinnati. Sparky Anderson likes Mike Lum, but much like some of the other players we've talked about, including Dave May, gets walked right into a logjam in the outfield in Cincinnati. You've got Ken Griffey, also George Foster, Cesar Geronimo are playing there, so he's kind of platooned in and out. But again, he now has an opportunity to play for a contending team. And of course, the Reds would be back-to-back World Series champions, sweeping the Yankees in 76 after that epic seven-game series against Boston in 1975. Now, he would pinch hit once in the playoffs, didn't play at all in the 76 World Series, still gets a ring out of it, however. And after a rough 1977 season, he would play winter ball in Venezuela, comes back to the Reds in 78 and actually hits 267 again in a platoon situation. And after the 1978 season, he returns to the Braves as a free agent. And after that, he led the National League with 17 pinch hits, got a little bit of playing time in 1980, but then basically gets pushed out to the Chicago Cubs, who are looking for a veteran bat. And then Lum would go on to play in Japan for a little while afterwards. Now, Mike Lum still involved in baseball. In fact, he has been a hitting consultant for the Gulf Coast League Pirates ever since 2010. And even though he's well into his 70s at last report, enjoying his role teaching young hitters in the Bradenton area. So now we move on to 1979, probably the least well-known of the five players in this collection of cards, but a well-known name, Paul Mitchell, the pitcher, not the hair care product. Paul Mitchell featured on the 1979 Topps card that I randomly pulled, and even though Paul Mitchell may be a somewhat forgettable player, he was part of a rather unforgettable trade, as he was traded in 1976 for Reggie Jackson and Ken Holtzman. So he went from Baltimore, went with Don Baylor and Mike Torres to Oakland for Ken Holtzman and Reggie Jackson. So that's the interesting trivia in the career of Paul Mitchell. But other than being a footnote to being part of a blockbuster trade, and it's a trade that's actually noted on the back of that 79 Topps card, he does have a little more to his life and career. Native of Worcester, Massachusetts, selected by the Pirates in the 18th round of the 1968 draft, could have gone pro, decided to go to college, had a scholarship to Old Dominion, so he went there, and eventually played three seasons in the Cape Cod Baseball League for the Falmouth Commodores, leading the Commodores to league championships in all 3 years. He was also the league's outstanding pitcher in the 1969 and 1970 season. So his opportunity with the Pirates passed. He gets selected by the Orioles in the secondary phase of the 1971 draft, very quickly moves up through their organization, makes his major league debut at Fenway Park on July 1st, 1975. As I mentioned, in 1976, part of that trade that brings Reggie Jackson to Baltimore for one season and also sends Don Baylor, Mike Torres, and Mitchell to Oakland as the A's are starting to get pulled apart. Mitchell did have a 9-7 record in Oakland in 76, but struggled early on in the 1977 season, gets traded to the expansion Seattle Mariners, and nobody really had any fun, with the Mariners in 1977 as an expansion team. He did, however, lead the Mariners in wins in 1978. As he had 8 wins. Yes, that was your wins leader for the 78 Mariners, who won only 58 games that season. In 79, he ends up in Milwaukee after the Mariners trade for Randy Stein. He would make his final major league appearance on September 21st, 1980. He was released prior to the 81 season. Now, even though he's a footnote in a major trade in Major League history, he is still contributing to the game. In fact, he was inducted into the Cape Cod Baseball League Hall of Fame back in 2002 and has served as an honorary captain of the Cape Cod Baseball League All-Star Game. So he is still very much active with that league and in and around his hometown of Worcester, Massachusetts. Finally, our card from 1980 features Dave Concepcion. What an incredible player, and by all words, an incredible person too. And as we'll discuss in a moment, Concepcion definitely has a case to be had in getting inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. Born in 1948 in Venezuela, he was able to get picked up by the Cincinnati Reds as a free agent. In 1967, an undrafted free agent, starts off in Tampa with the Tarpons in the Florida State League in 1968, very quickly moves up to the major leagues, in fact, is making his major league debut in 1970, but at the time, not getting a whole lot of playing time because Darryl Chaney, who I was talking about, also Woody Woodward, were staples at shortstop. At the time. So Sparky Anderson's platooning him and is also helping him become a better hitter. And slowly but surely, Concepcion becomes not just a better hitter, but a better infielder as well. By 1973, he is pretty much locking down the shortstop position and will become a key cog, but often overlooked cog, of the Big Red Machine in the mid-1970s. Now, offensively, he had a pretty solid career, but also defensively as well. And he was one of many players who took advantage of the turf at Riverfront Stadium. And not just at Riverfront Stadium. Think about the National League in the mid-1970s. You had a lot of turf stadiums. Candlestick Park had turf. Of course, you had the Astrodome, Pittsburgh, and St. Louis. They all had turf. So you have more and more teams playing on the artificial turf, and he would take advantage of that, you know, especially with deep throws from the hole between short and third. He would perfect the art of bouncing the ball at a certain spot in the infield to get the out at first base. So it not only helped him stay in the game, but also reduced a little bit of the wear and tear in his arm of trying to make those deep throws from shortstop to first base to get a runner out. Like I said, he wasn't the only player who did it, but certainly is probably the best remembered player for doing it, as he was able to make a pretty good habit of it, and of course being part of a winning team with the Cincinnati Reds throughout the mid to late 70s. People tend to remember that, even though Concepcion said he learned it from Brooks Robinson. So he tended to learn from the best and was able to make an art form out of it. Now, he would play for many, many, many years, was the MVP at the All-Star Game in 1982, had a two-run home run to help the National League win 4-1, and also would play throughout the 1988 season. Was let go from the Reds, tried to come back in 1989 with the Angels, however, did not make the roster out of spring training. Now, he is an executive at a trucking company in Venezuela, and he has also had his number 13 retired by the Reds. He is in the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame, and there's a very good argument that Concepcion should be in the Major League Hall of Fame. And keep an eye on what happens with Omar Vizquel. Of course, Vizquel with 37% of the vote last year. That was his first year being eligible. But Vizquel has very similar numbers to Concepcion. In fact, slightly better numbers in some categories. But David Concepcion, 19 seasons, as I mentioned, all with the Cincinnati Reds. Career batting average of .267. He had 2,326 hits. He was a 9-time All-Star, 5-time Gold Glove Award winner, 2-time Silver Slugger, and of course, 2-time World Champion in 1975 and 76. So for all the bellyaching for players such as Harold Baines and Tim Raines and Edgar Martinez, you know, you've got some traditionalists who go, oh, they're not Hall of Famers. And again, you can make an argument either way. Benefactors of those guys getting inducted into the Hall of Fame are players such as Omar Vizquel and, to a greater extent, Concepcion, because if Vizquel can get in, and it may, he may have to go down the Edgar Martinez route where it takes several years before things line up perfectly and he gets in. Certainly Tim Raines took him 10 years before things lined up and he got in. David Concepcion, of course, it would have to be through the Veterans Committee, could also get in. I think you're seeing more and more people, and especially with sabermetrics and advanced statistics, looking at Concepcion's career as a whole, as well as the reality that for basically the first three or four seasons of his major league career, he didn't play that much because he was one of three people who could play the shortstop position. That was a detriment to him. Had he been a starter in 1970 or even 71, he probably would have eclipsed the 3,000 hit plateau, probably could have picked up another All-Star nomination or a Gold Glove Award, and I think would have been a shoe-in. You wouldn't have had a Veterans Committee decision. He probably would have been elected sometime in the mid to late 1990s. So a lot of good reasons for Davey Concepcion to get into the Hall of Fame. And again, watch Vizquel, see how his path goes, and we'll see if David Concepcion follows or perhaps leads the way. Because again, with Baines and Martinez and Raines, you're going to have more and more people looking at careers as a whole. And instead of just looking at a benchmark such as 3,000 hits or 400 home runs, they're going to look at the whole career and go, yeah, that guy should definitely be in there. So there you go, a fun look at the players from 1976 through 1980, just random selections from not a shoebox, not a Velveeta box, but a fun little box of cards that I have from the late 70s and 1980, which tied in again rather nicely with our guest Dan Epstein, and I can't thank him enough for joining us earlier today. A lot of fun things that we discussed. A lot of fun things from you via our timeline, our Twitter timeline, Wax and Gum Stains. We encourage you to continue keeping the conversation going there. And once again, we continue to ask you, please, if you've got a few dollars, even if it's just $5, feel free to donate it via PayPal to our fund at paypal.me/waxecstatic, as you will help keep the program going strong, over 140 episodes and going, and also help us buy the products that we get to talk about on the air and then get to share with kids through Commons for Kids and Kidority Cards. Again, that is paypal.me/waxecstatic. All right, our next program, 2 weeks from today. Looking forward to doing that and talking to you about some classic cardboard on our next episode of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. We'll talk to you next time.